From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, colleges and universities brace for the Republican tax plan.
It's baffling to me when we are in the era of the knowledge economy. Congress is trying to impose a tax on knowledge.
Keeping Michigan's manufacturing strong.
Michigan is one of the real heartbeats of American manufacturing sector.
From Birmingham to Broadway and back to Michigan, we talk theater with actor Terry Hansen, starring in An American in Paris.
It is life-changing, if not forever, for those two precious hours that you are experiencing live theater.
And John U. Bacon on the Lions' messy win over the Bears.
Style points do not count in the NFL. There are no polls. There are no rankings. All you have to do is win and get on the bus and go home.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, can manufacturing make it in America? A new report examines what hurt manufacturing in the past and looks at where it might go in the future. That story coming up in about 20 minutes. But first, Congress, as we know, is now considering two different tax reform bills with pressure from the president to get a final version on his desk before year's end. Universities and colleges are worried that both the House and Senate tax plans could threaten higher education. Of special concern, a proposed 1.4% excise tax on wealthy private college endowments. Among the college leaders closely watching this tax plan is the president of Kalamazoo College. Jorge Gonzalez, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate having an opportunity to talk with you about this.
President Gonzalez, just to get us all on the same page, how do these endowments happen? How are they structured?
Very good question. And basically what happens is that you have friends of the college, most of the time they're alumni, sometimes they're members of the community, which strongly believe in what the college or the university does. And when they believe in this, they say, you know what I want to do is provide you resources so that forever you'll be able to support this particular activity. And so some of them will give you money that you invest, and it's going to provide scholarships. Others provide money to support professors. Others support research. Others support study abroad, a variety of things. But again, these are people that give you the money, that trust you with that money for you to do something good with the earnings.
So you clearly put them to use in many, many ways.
Absolutely. And I will put them to use to provide more access to college and to do what we do a lot better.
And now here Congress is looking for new tax revenue, and both the House and Senate have zeroed in on these private college endowments with this proposed excise tax of 1.4% on net investment income. So if this tax passes in its proposed form, what could that mean to your college in dollars and cents?
In this particular moment, and that the version that was approved by the House would not affect us, because what they're saying is only affects those colleges that have an endowment that is more than $250,000 per student. We're not quite there yet. I wish we had that much money. We don't have quite that much money yet. However, this affects a number of universities. And more importantly, this opens the door for that threshold to continue to change over time, and eventually it will tax our earnings.
So you feel like the door is being kicked in?
Absolutely. The door has been kicked in, and that's incredibly dangerous territory to step in, because the result of this is that the revenues that we'll receive from the endowment will be diminished, and as a result of that, our ability to provide access to high-quality education to students that cannot afford it will be diminished. And also, our ability to deliver first-rate education will be hindered by this, because we'll have less revenue to be able to do all the things that we want to do for our students.
So you're at this point, as you say, you're just under that. Might not affect you now, but you do feel that the door is definitely being kicked open.
You are correct. And again, it is a very dangerous precedent. This is money that was given to the colleges by private donors because they wanted to be used by the college to support our activities. And it was their understanding, as it's been for many, many years, that those earnings will be used 100% to support the college, and not a part of it going away to pay some tax that has never existed before.
So you feel handcuffed.
Absolutely. And again, it's baffling to me that in a time when we are in the era of the knowledge economy, Congress is trying to impose a tax on knowledge.
Well, Business Insider reports that the top 10 private university endowments by size hold an unbelievable amount of wealth, many billions of dollars in endowment funds. Why should these not be looked at for tax revenue, in your view?
Again, my concern is not necessarily for those top 10, is that the moment that you open that door, you're going to have increases in taxes, and it's going to be affecting more and more and more endowments and more and more and more colleges. And then going into the long term, donors are going to have to start thinking, well, should I really be giving the money to the college now, given that I know that some of that money is going to be taken away in the form of taxes? So you diminish the incentives for donors to give money to the colleges, and at the same time, you open the door for eventually affecting more and more colleges.
And how might that be felt on the ground by students?
Well, the way that is felt is that all of a sudden your financial aid offer is going to be smaller, or your scholarships to study abroad or to do research with a faculty member are going to be smaller and non-existent, or our ability to pay our faculty and staff the salaries that we'd like to pay them is going to be hurt.
And do I hear you say that that would certainly push colleges and universities to having to rely on tuition, meaning higher tuition?
It could be either higher tuition or lower scholarships, one or the other. And at the end of the day, what it means is a high net price for students to be able to attend college. So once again, what we're going to be doing here is hindering access to college, hinder access to knowledge at a time where we should be promoting the acquisition of knowledge.
President Gonzalez, more broadly, both the House and Senate Republican tax bills have ideas that could mean big changes to higher education in our country. House Republicans want to combine three separate tax credits for higher ed expenses into one and eliminate both the student loan interest deduction and tax-free tuition reimbursement from employers. The House would also repeal the tax code provision that lets colleges and universities waive the cost of tuition for grad students. Now, for the Senate plan, it does include the tax on endowments, but as of now, as we talk, things are being crafted, but it appears to have not touched many of those education tax credits and exemptions that the House bill takes away. But things can change. I'm wondering how much pushback power you feel that leaders of colleges and universities have as this tax reform plan is being crafted.
That's a great question. And obviously, colleges and universities are very active talking to our legislators to tell them how damaging those provisions will be. Because in sum, all of those provisions, what they do is they increase the cost of providing an education, and they reduce the revenues that we have to provide a good education. So if those things are put into place, it's going to make it harder for us to provide access to college, and it's going to decrease our ability to produce a high-quality education.
There are many college officials across the country saying this feels like an attack on higher education. What are your feelings when you look at these bills about how congressional Republicans seem to view higher education more broadly?
Yeah, as I said, it's kind of baffling that you'll be trying to get resources from a place that you need to be putting more resources into. Higher education has been one of the star industries of the U.S. economy. There's few industries that are more competitive than higher education, that has an annual payroll over $100 billion. Why would you go after this industry, the one that plants the seeds for the growth of the economy?
Jorge Gonzalez, president of Kalamazoo College. We want to thank you, President Gonzalez, very much for taking time to speak with us today on Stateside.
It's been a pleasure to be with you today. Thank you.
It is time now for our weekly check-in with Michigan Radio sports commentator John Eubank. And let's start with the very most important thing, more important than W's and L's, and that is a player's health. Michigan quarterback Brandon Peters took a ferocious hit Saturday in that loss to Wisconsin. Knocked him right out, didn't it?
It did, and he was on the ground for quite a while, which is always a scary situation.
Absolutely.
Now he got up and was on the cart and high-fived his teammates and whatnot, so it's not a spinal situation. It is some form of head injury. We don't know how severe. They don't have to. In the NFL, they have to tell you. In colleges, they don't. So we don't really know right now, but he took the team flight home. We know that, so it's probably within a certain range.
Too early to tell when he might be back? Or?
Too early to tell, but it's certainly possible that he will be back.
Okay, but if he's sidelined, who might be starting quarterback?
Almost certainly John O'Korn, which means Michigan has very little chance, frankly. Mm. Nice guy, hard worker, but not getting it done.
Okay, so
keep in mind, in fairness to the Wolverines and Harbaugh and so on, your starting quarterback, Weldon Spate, also got knocked out by a late and cheap hit. So in the Purdue game, then you go O'Korn, who didn't work out that well. Mm-hmm. Then you go to Brandon Peters, who's done pretty well. on the grand scale. And now he's out also. So you're bouncing back and forth between second and third string quarterbacks. That's not an ideal situation.
Not indeed. And expectations were high for a signature win for Michigan, playing against that team that was hoping to get into the college playoffs. And in fact, for nearly three quarters, Michigan really was the better team. Better chances, looked like be the one you picked. So what happened?
And that's Wisconsin, obviously, who is undefeated, and now they're 11-0. What happened is very simply, Brennan Peters got knocked out of the game. Sadly, it's that simple.
And here we've got Ohio State coming next weekend.
I was doing an interview last night with people in Columbus, and they said, are Michigan fans numb or just in dread? And I said, both. It's been a rough decade, to say the least, for the Michigan-Ohio State rivalry, where in all the games, Michigan has been the underdog, except for 2011, probably. And for them to win this game, Peters has got to be playing. He's got to be healthy. Or Spate possibly might be back. Very unlikely, but possible. And they've got to pull about five rabbits out of a hat. So the odds here are not very good. Furthermore, Ohio State needs style points to get into the college football playoff. They have two losses. They need two big wins over Michigan and Wisconsin to get there. So they will not hesitate to put 50 on Michigan if they can.
Boy. Now let's talk about the Spartans improving to 8-3 with that win over Maryland, now number 21. Another gutsy performance in horrible conditions.
True. And look, I mean, what you and I said in the offseason, and they called us crazy, Cindy. They called us crazy. We said, look, just get back to fundamental D'Antonio football. They have done that. They're not flashy. It's not a great team, and they were exposed versus Ohio State and other truly great teams. But they're playing solid, serious football, and that's all you have to do to go 8-3, and they're going to be 9-3 after this weekend.
With Rutgers.
Which is as close as you can get to a homecoming dance.
All right. Over to the Lions, eking out a win literally by the skin of their teeth in Chicago. Was that a game Detroit deserved to win?
In the NFL, it doesn't matter. The answer is no. But so what? Style points do not count in the NFL. There are no polls. There are no rankings. All you have to do is win and get on the bus and go home. They did those things, and they are now 6-4.
And now they've got the Vikings coming for Ford Field action on Thanksgiving Day. What are your thoughts?
Look, they beat them at Minnesota, so it's possible. They have to win this game to win the division. There's no question. They're two games now behind the Vikings. Detroit traditionally performed. I looked this up at one point. About 20% better they do on Thanksgiving Day than they do the rest of the season. And this goes back to 1934. They're playing this game on Thanksgiving before it was a national holiday. That's how far back this goes.
Quite the tradition. Michigan Radio Sports commentator John Eubank. And as always, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Coming up, we'll talk theater with actor Terry Hansen. She's starring in An American in Paris. That's in 10 minutes right here on Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Entrepreneurship.
Part of the community. The next idea.
We are the key to our own recovery.
Michiganders know full well the effects of manufacturing's decline in this country. But a new report points out ways to ensure that manufacturing stays alive here. And with 1 in 7 workers in our state still employed in this sector, it's a challenge that we need to address. The report is called Making It in America, Revitalizing U.S. Manufacturing. It was released this month by the McKinsey Global Institute, a leading private sector think tank. It examines just what hurt manufacturing in the past and, more importantly, explores where it might go in the future. One of the lead authors is Katie George, a senior partner at McKinsey. Katie George is here now. Welcome to The Next Idea.
Thank you very much.
So we can look back at those not-so-distant decades when Michigan's economy rested on the bedrock of manufacturing, and we think about what the changing global economy combined with the Great Recession did to that. And your report really proves that between 1999 and 2016, Michigan lost one-third of its manufacturing jobs?
Yes, that's right. Although I would say also that Michigan was one of the fastest to rebound, thanks to Michigan's strengths in manufacturing, in particular in vehicles, which is a part of the manufacturing sector that really responds well to improved demand and improved economy overall.
And the report is very clear that despite that decline, manufacturing is very crucial to Michigan's economy. What areas are dominating manufacturing in our state now?
So in Michigan, first of all, the manufacturing sector is a full fifth of Michigan's economy. So even though we talk about the decline in manufacturing in Michigan and in the United States overall, Michigan is still a manufacturing powerhouse, as is the United States. The United States is the second largest manufacturing economy in the world. And Michigan is one of the real heartbeats of the American manufacturing sector. So manufacturing is a fifth of Michigan's economy, similar to the share that manufacturing plays in Germany's economy. And the strengths that Michigan has are first in vehicles and large kind of machinery industries, but also in things that we call regional processing, so food processing and other industries that really respond well to the local market.
So certainly it is something worth investing in.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Michigan has real strengths in manufacturing, and as we think about the opportunity for revitalization of the U.S. manufacturing sector in general, Michigan's got to be a core part of that.
So let's talk about how Michigan can capture future opportunities in revitalizing its manufacturing segment. What are the main assets that Michigan has that can be used to really, give new life to manufacturing production?
Yeah, as part of our report, we did a review of state-by-state assets around manufacturing and strengths, and Michigan came up very strong. Particularly, Michigan has a very strong physical infrastructure. Michigan also has strong R&D, which we think will increasingly drive where manufacturing capital investments are made. And Michigan also has great access to markets. It's one of the leaders in exporting across the United States. So that combined with the strength in the automotive sector as well as in regional processing industries really is a fantastic backbone for future growth in manufacturing for the state.
And what could that mean to the future, to increase manufacturing production? What could it mean in terms of dollars for the state's economy, Katie, and also new jobs?
Well, we did a modeling exercise to look at what we thought the potential for U.S. manufacturing overall and for Michigan specifically would be. And we estimated that for Michigan, it could be $30 billion more of GDP into the Michigan economy and 170,000 jobs.
Okay, that is worth fighting for. So what needs to happen in Michigan to make sure that manufacturing is viable in terms of state policymakers, business leaders, schools and colleges and universities?
There are really three things that are going to be critical to make manufacturing competitive in the future. The first is aggressive investment in new technologies. Industry 4.0 technologies, advanced automation and robotics, machine learning and other advanced analytics tools, digital manufacturing, all of these new technologies will be as big a revolution to the manufacturing economy as the assembly line was back in its day. And so it will be critical for Michigan firms to invest in these new technologies and to be cutting edge. In order to do so, the second big thing is to invest in the workforce. Right now, we don't have the skills in our workforce to actually fill even today's advanced manufacturing jobs. And the jobs that will be created in the future will require even more skill. So really developing the workforce in advanced manufacturing skills will be critical. And then the third thing I would say is to ensure that we are developing not just the large firms, but that the supply base overall, the small and medium firms, are coming along as well in terms of their access and use of new technologies and their access to skilled workers.
So these small to mid-sized firms just need more support.
Absolutely. One of the things we found is that even as U.S. manufacturing overall has declined, there's actually a segment of firms, the very largest ones, over $1 billion in revenue. Those large firms have continued to grow over 2% a year. So large firms are doing well, but the small and medium-sized manufacturers have been left behind. They have not been able to invest in new technologies. They have not been able to get skilled workers, and that becomes a really vicious cycle downward. It's dangerous, obviously, for that whole sector of the industry, and a lot of our employment is there. But it's also dangerous in that it means that even our large firms will be forced to go outside to find the suppliers that they need. So in order to really reinvigorate and strengthen our entire manufacturing sector, we have to make sure that the small and medium enterprises are coming along for the ride.
There is plenty of food for thought in this new report from the McKinsey Global Institute. Once again, it's titled Making It in America, Revitalizing U.S. Manufacturing. And we have put a link to this report on the stateside page at michiganradio.org so you can kind of dive in and really look at all the work that Katie George and her co-authors have done. Katie George is with the McKinsey Global Institute. And we want to thank you so much, Katie, for being with us on The Next Idea.
It's my pleasure.
Support for the Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
Right now, all over Michigan, high schools are putting on their fall theater productions. Taking part in a school play can help a kid discover something she never knew she had inside. Somebody who's shy somehow finds the key to shining on stage, and that's something that can change the course of a life. And that's what happened for Terry Hansen when she tried out for a play at Seaholm High School in Birmingham. Today, that girl who never saw music or theater in her future is starring in An American in Paris. The Tony-winning musical will be at the Detroit Opera House from November 28th through December 10th. And Terry Hansen is with us. Now, Terry, welcome to Stateside.
I'm delighted to be here, Cynthia. You certainly have done your research on me.
Well, and I can relate because I am the parent of someone who did theater all through high school and college. And I understand when you started at Seaholm, you didn't have dreams of Broadway or the stage. What did you think you wanted to do for a career?
Not at all. I grew up in Detroit, in a suburb of Detroit, watching Graham Kerr on television, and of course I wanted to be a chef.
The Galloping Gourmet, right?
The Galloping Gourmet, and I was accepted into the American Culinary Institute in New York, and that was my dream. But I had two dear friends who may listen to the show, Jay McCafarsky and Diane Vopel, and I was a very shy band geek, math nerd. And we were in the car one day and singing along to the radio, and they said, you know, Terry, you've got a pretty good voice. You should audition for the musical. And that really changed the trajectory of my life, just getting a little encouragement from my friends, and it really transformed me. I mean, the power of music, and I had played the flute for years and been a marching band, but something about the art of song and also portraying another character really brought me out of my shell, and I've been doing it ever since.
And what was that first play?
Well, I actually did Hello, Dolly, which my dear friend Andy Einhorn is now conducting on Broadway with Bette Midler, of course. I was in the chorus, and then I went on to do Marion the Librarian in The Music Man, a role that I later did touring the United States not so long ago. You know, it launched me into some really wonderful repertoire right away.
And you won a scholarship to Central Michigan University?
I did. My wonderful high school choir teacher, I only took choir for a half a semester my senior year, Eugene Brandstrom. Many people know and remember him. He passed away a few years ago, but he had quite a legacy. And he encouraged me. My father had passed away, my father who played for the Detroit Lions, and he knew I was going to be paying for college on my own. And he said, Terry, I think you can get a scholarship. So I learned Voi che sapete from Le Nozze di Figaro, and the rest is history.
And what do you think you got, Terry, from your training at Central that helped you as you went on to build a professional career, especially considering the odds are so stacked against that actually happening?
To talk about my experience at Central Michigan, not only was it incredibly well-rounded because I started many of the straight theater plays, I sang with the jazz band, I was in the madrigals, the concert choir, so I had such an incredibly well-rounded experience, you know, studied German and Italian. It was a magical time for me, and not only academically, but the friends that I developed there are friends that I still have. And when I come back to Michigan with these Broadway tours or singing with the Detroit Symphony or the East Lansing Symphony or Grand Rapids Symphony or West Michigan Symphony, I am able to reconnect with those people. So Central Michigan gave me a wonderfully well-rounded experience. And really, as a performer, as you go out, as you said, it's so rare that people actually do have a successful lifelong career as a performer. You know, just having those life experiences really prepared me for the challenges that I would face in New York, I also performed a lot in Europe and toured with Marvin Hamlisch for years. So it just made me a well-rounded person.
So as you say, you've performed a lot in Michigan. You were at Camelot at the Fisher and Sound of Music, and here you are, you know, in East Lansing now and then coming to the Detroit Opera House with An American in Paris. What kind of memories or thoughts hit you when you step out in front of a hometown crowd?
Oh, there's nothing like it. And I must say, though I grew up in Birmingham and my dad, you know, as I said, played for the Lions, really, the whole state of Michigan, I was Miss Isabella County. I mean, I traveled to every town. I crowned Miss Maple Syrup Festival and Shepherd. I went all over. Kehlani Ray Rafko, who, of course, was our one Miss Michigan, who won the Miss America pageant. I crowned her at her local Heart of Michigan pageant. She crowned me as Miss Isabella County. So the whole state I feel very, very connected to. So the generosity, the warmth, the feeling that no matter where you're from, you belong here. And it's a great feeling to come home.
What's your favorite Gershwin number from An American in Paris? I mean, it's just such a hit parade of Gershwin gems.
Well, I mean, that's like, probably one of the most difficult questions to answer when you've got the American in Paris suite, The Man I Love. You've got It's Wonderful, But Not For Me. I mean, how do you choose one among those? If I'm forced to choose, because I'm such a sentimental sap, not to quote a Richard Rodgers song, but, you know, The Man I Love has got to be my favorite. It's an iconic song, as all of these songs are, and people will just be lifted up out of their seats, as they are every night in doing this show. It's just delicious. It's comfort music for the soul.
And do you see young people in those audiences, Terry? I'm interested in how you see these iconic numbers from the American songbook. How does that hit the young people who, you know, the music that they're tuning into is just a little bit different in a feel and an approach?
Sure. Well, it's not only that, but when you're doing live theater and you're competing for audience members, I have to say Broadway has had such a resurgence over the last 15 years. Rosie O'Donnell did a lot to promote Broadway on her show, and more people are not only coming to New York, but coming to these Broadway tours. Of course, you can't help but mention Lin-Manuel Miranda and, you know, Hamilton setting the course for a whole new 21st century era of American musical theater involving rap. But all of that stemmed from the classic musical theater, Rodgers and Hammerstein, Kern, Lerner and Lowe, and, of course, George and Ira Gershwin. These songs, even for the youngest of young teenagers who come and see the show and are awestruck. We had somebody write that they grew up in Michigan, and when they were 11 years old, they went and saw a musical, and it completely changed their life. And they said, you know, welcome to Michigan. Don't forget that somewhere out there, there's an 11-year-old boy who was me 30 years ago sitting in the audience ready for his life to be changed, not knowing how your life is going to be changed, experiencing not only this show, this Tony Award-winning show, but any live theater, a symphony orchestra concert. When you go to live theater, when you experience the American musical theater, the great American songbook, as you said, which includes so many, you know, Cole Porter and all of these wonderful, fantastic writers, lyricists, composers, it is life-changing, if not forever, for those two precious hours that you are experiencing live theater.
And I think just a good postscript to parents whose high schoolers say, I want to do a play, go ahead. Don't say no. They'll find a way to do their homework, and they'll also be able to get that experience of stepping out on a stage.
Absolutely. And music, theater, the arts are transformative. They influence every aspect of your life. And, you know, analogous to that is sports. When you're actively doing something that takes your focus, your mind away from the challenges of the world when you put down your iPhone, when you put down your remote control, and you get out and you experience art. Even going to a museum, experiencing art does change your point of view about the world. And that's something we can all use.
Michigander Terry Hansen plays Madame Borel?
Well, bien sûr, Madame Borel.
Yeah, well, there you've got it down. In the production of An American in Paris at the Detroit Opera House from November 28th to December 10th. Terry, thank you for spending time with us.
I'm still smitten with a mitten. Always will be. Delighted to speak with you, Cynthia.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Still to come. Starting in 2020, a third grader who doesn't meet a certain reading proficiency level will have to repeat that grade. After the break, we'll find out how some school districts and teachers are preparing for potential surge in English language learners who could be held back. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. Michigan is one of the 15 states plus the District of Columbia with a third grade reading retention law. Starting in 2020, a third grader who doesn't meet a certain reading proficiency level will have to repeat that grade. My next guest has been studying just what this law could mean for students who are English language learners, ELL students. Paula Winke is with Michigan State University's Second Language Studies program. It's so good to have you with us, Paula.
Thank you for having me.
Now, you recently unveiled research into this very question about ELL students and the third grade reading law. What question were you seeking to answer with your research?
At Michigan State University, my colleague Xiaowan Zhang and I, we work with a lot of teachers who are teaching ELLs in the Michigan public schools. And we were wondering, if this law passes, which it did, how is it going to affect English language learners in the state of Michigan? How would it affect our colleagues who are teaching ESL in the public schools? How would it affect their jobs? And we actually wanted some numbers. How many kids in their classrooms would be set to repeat third grade?
And how do you go about that? I understand you were looking at test data and trying to kind of extrapolate what would happen. How do you go about that?
Well, what we thought we would do is apply the law as it's written to the last set of test data that was available, and that was the spring 2016 data from the Michigan Department of Education. They have a formal program where researchers can go through a process of requesting access to the data without names. And we did that. We requested data for all of the third grade children in the state of Michigan who took the test in 2016. We then applied the law to the data to see if the law had been in effect in 2016, what would it have done to the ELL, the English language learner population.
As you understand it, what was the reasoning behind this third grade reading law?
Well, there's a lot of theory about how children in general, not just English language learners, learn to read. And these state retention laws that are in 14 different states in the District of Columbia all have the same tenet. They have the same foundation. And it's based on research that's shown that third graders, they undergo a transition from learning to read to reading to learn. And the theory is that if by third grade you're not proficient in reading, you're going to be less able to learn the fourth grade content, that in fourth grade you are learning a content-based curriculum, and you need to be able to read proficiently or at a high enough level to be academically successful.
What is the reading level, Paula, that would determine whether that youngster repeats third grade or moves on to fourth grade?
Well, according to the law, it's third graders who read below grade level reading shall not pass on to fourth grade. It's up to the Michigan Department of Education to set that threshold to actually create a cut score in the Michigan reading test. It would be the English Language Arts test on the M-STEP. There has been a lot of proposals. And according to the legislation, the language that's used in the statute is that it's children who are below the proficient mark. So we took that in our data when we were applying the CUT score to the 2016 data, and that's children who are at level one or level two on the M-STEP, so they're either labeled as not proficient or partially proficient. But the Michigan Department of Education has not yet officially stated what the official cut point will be.
So take us to what you found as far as the potential impact of this law on ELL students. What did you learn?
If we use that cut point that's commonly accepted as what we think will be the cut between level two and three, anyone below proficient, what we found is that out of all of the children in the state of Michigan who are English language learners, there are about 9,000 of them. We also wanted to look at how many different home languages they have. By getting the data from the Michigan Department of Education, we found out we're talking about 131 different home languages. And we did set the pass rate, and for these almost 9,000 children in the state of Michigan, only 31% of them will pass.
Some may ask, is it such a bad thing if a child isn't reading at the appropriate level that he repeats third grade and gets better at reading before moving up to fourth grade? You know, I guess I'm wondering, is that idea any different for ELL students?
Yes, and I think that this is what really made us feel the urgency in conducting this research is that the theories on English language learners and how they progress in reading, it's a very different story from the regular monolingual English population. That we know from second language acquisition literature and research in Canada on bilingualism that children who are learning two languages at the same time, especially in the early years, kindergarten, first, second, third, fourth grade, they lag behind in their English reading skills because they're building up so much vocabulary, grammar, while they're still learning their home languages as well. And that bilingual development shows up in a slowdown of reading acquisition, but only for a certain amount of time. Children have that lag for 3 to 7 years, but then after that, they start to progress very quickly in reading in the language of instruction, and they end up leapfrogging their peers. So there are cognitive benefits that show up later in life that are extremely beneficial from having that bilingual background. And that theory, that mapping of how English language learners progress in reading, is not represented by the law. In the third grade reading retention laws, the theory that they're based on are more general commonalities with monolingual speakers. It doesn't really map onto what English language learners do. There are a lot of research papers out there, qualitative and quantitative ones, but mostly qualitative, on what happens to a child when they are held back in third grade. By that time, they've had their social unit set up. They're, you know, very happy with their peers. And there is a lot of evidence that they can be psychologically harmed. And actually, retention that has been studied has shown that it leads to a reduction in the graduation rate in high school.
Do you feel that this law needs to be adjusted in some way to allow for ELL students and the way they're learning?
That would be great. There are provisions written in the law such that there's a couple that are key for English language learners. The first one is that English language learners, if they've had less than 3 years of instruction in English, their parents can apply for a good cause exemption. And the way it's written in the law is the parent will get a letter in the mail giving the parent the child's test score. And the Michigan Department of Education will be sending that letter, and the letter will be in English, and it will say your child has been slated to repeat third grade, but you have 30 days in which to apply to the superintendent of your school to ask for a good cause exemption if your child has had less than 3 years of English language instruction.
So you're afraid that letter is going to hit a mailbox and the parent won't understand it?
Yes, especially since I mentioned that there are 131 different home languages. And the largest five groups of languages that we looked at were Spanish, Arabic, Bengali, Albanian, and Chinese. Those are the largest English language learner subgroups in Michigan. And I think what we can ask teachers to do, and maybe the state of Michigan, is to make sure that letter can be translated into those different languages. The law does state that school districts can send an additional letter to the families to explain the content of the letter written in English from the Michigan Department of Education. So we think ELL teachers and school districts need to get proactive in identifying the first graders who are in their classes now. What are their home languages, and will you be able to translate those letters or communicate to those parents the content of the letter that will come from the Michigan Department of Education?
Paula, you have said this law, you see it as a social experiment. What do you mean by that?
Well, this type of mass retention of holding back, you know, up to 70% of all English language learners in the state when they are in third grade is something that really has not been studied. And looking at the numbers, we became worried because the retention policy will hit in certain demographic groups more strongly. It will hit males, because boys tend to do a little bit worse on standardized tests for whatever reason of socialization, I'm not sure. And so when we look at boys, their pass rate dips below 30%, and girls in the English language learner population hover around 34%. But it gets worse if the boys are from economically disadvantaged families. Then their pass rate goes down even further to 25%. And it's even worse if they are Spanish native speakers. Then their pass rate goes down to less than 20%. So it's Spanish and Arabic speaking children who we found the lowest pass rates. And those are our two largest English language learner populations in Michigan.
I guess, what do you think should happen now from this research that you've done? What do you hope happens?
Well, I think we can approach it in three ways. We can assume that the law will come into effect in 2020, and the first group of people that we can approach are the Michigan superintendents of the public schools, because they are the ones who are allowed to grant good cause exemptions for ELLs and other subgroups of students. English language teachers need to work with the superintendents in identifying the native languages of the parents of the ELL children who are in first grade now. They'll be the first wave of children affected in 2020. And to get them ready with templates, letters that they will have prepared, because we already know by the numbers don't lie. Even with the extra instruction that's being put in place now, there will still be large percentages of ELLs who will qualify for the exemption but yet need to apply for it. And there's a provision in the law saying that superintendents can approve an alternative assessment measure. So we know that English language learners in the state of Michigan are required to take the WEDA English Language Proficiency Assessment alongside the general M-STEP reading assessment, the English Language Arts Test. And we would like to propose that that WEDA test be looked at as a approved alternative measure for ELLs.
It sounds like you there's work to be done in kind of getting the case made to the superintendents for the ELL students in their districts.
Yeah, the superintendents could also approve a portfolio or any other type of alternative measure for any child if they wanted to. But those alternative instruments haven't been identified or approved, and superintendents and English language learning teachers in the state could work to get those on board before the law comes into effect.
Paula Winke with Michigan State University, the Second Language Studies Program. I want to thank you so much for sharing your work with us on Stateside today.
Thank you very much.
So how are school districts and teachers preparing for a potential surge in English language learners who may be held back because of the third grade reading retention law? Suzanne Tuohy develops curricula and assessment for English language learners for Oakland schools, and she's with us now. Suzanne, how many ELL students do you think you have in Oakland schools?
We have approximately 15,000 English learners in Oakland County.
That's a sizable number. And how do you think that this third grade reading and retention law might affect those students in your district?
Our districts have been preparing to support the English learners and their families regarding the law. We've been preparing since the law was enacted. And from the ground level up, working on programming to support English learners, interventions that are appropriate for English learners, and providing professional learning through the county and ISD to support the educators who are teaching those students. There are, within the law, there are some loopholes or good cause exemptions that English learners qualify for based on certain criteria. So this is not just for English learners, but for any student who maybe doesn't reach proficiency on the third grade exam. So if an English learner teacher or a gen ed teacher or a parent or someone else in the child's life says, I want to request this good cause exemption, this student shouldn't be retained due to various factors, they can request that exemption, and it's ultimately up to the superintendent or the superintendent's designee to determine whether or not to grant the good cause exemption.
So someone more there on the ground, it's not going up to Lansing to have someone there decide.
That's correct. I anticipate, although we don't know for sure because it's not that decision's not upon us yet, but mm-hmm. I would anticipate the educational team for the student would make those decisions. So for the case of English learners, I would imagine that the general education teacher and the English learner teacher or support or administrator would work together to make those decisions on which students they should request a good cause exemption for.
How can a district plan ahead, looking down the line in a couple of years, the idea of having youngsters repeating third grade when you don't know how they're going to fare on the assessment test? What kind of planning goes into that?
So the districts are encouraging their teachers to participate and taking them through some professional learning to increase their proficiency as educators in providing literacy instruction. We're also, outside of that piece, looking at how can we best educate parents, and my role, particularly the parents of English learners. So we're looking at some read-at-home plans, some supporting literacy development at home, which includes educating parents about the benefits to continued education in the first language. The stronger student skills are in literacy in the first language, the stronger their skills will be in English. And so continuing to work with parents as our allies to include the reading at home and literacy development at home practices, the districts are doing that work as well with families. They're also preparing some materials that need to go out to families. So the information letter, for example, about what is this reading law and how might it affect my child, we at the Oakland County level have developed translations of that original document in 12 languages so that our districts don't have to spend their resources doing that. Individual districts, everyone needs, let's say, Arabic, everyone needs Spanish. So here we've developed kind of some templates that they can use. And so we're planning to continue that kind of work so that we can work together collaboratively around these resources we need to share with families in multiple languages.
Suzanne, do you feel this law is a good idea? I mean, to have a youngster repeat third grade if he or she is not hitting that certain standard in reading assessment tests?
It's very complicated because there's a lot of research that says that retention is not effective. It's not an effective intervention. But I do think that a focus on students' literacy is a fortunate byproduct of the law, that we are now, because of the law, required to look at writing individual reading improvement plans for students, and English learners are benefiting from that focused look, intensive look at instruction in literacy.
So overall, are you feeling confident that when the law kicks in and it's time to take this test, that third graders in your district are in Oakland schools are going to do all right and move on up?
It's really hard to say, and I think it's early. We're just in the first year of doing the required diagnostic and interim assessments. So it's really hard to predict, and the cut scores for the M-STEP have changed frequently over the years. So it's sort of, I think it's difficult to predict how the students will fare. I do think there are some workarounds in place so that we have a fair look at the student's overall performance. So if the student doesn't score passing or proficient on that one snapshot, there are alternate pathways to meet those requirements, and there are workarounds for students who have IEPs or students who are English learners who haven't received the 3 years of instruction in the program. But I think at this point, it's really difficult to predict.
But at least you've got some ramp-up time, so this just didn't descend suddenly.
Yes, and our districts, once we saw that this was the law was passed, we immediately went into problem-solving mode. How can we get ahead of it? What can we do to prepare teachers? What can we do to prepare parents so that we can do as much in advance of that 2019-2020 deadline so that we can make sure our students are as prepared as possible for that exam?
Suzanne Tuohy develops curricula and assessment for English language learners for Oakland Schools. It was great talking with you, Suzanne. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Today's Stateside was directed by Ellie Billings and engineered by Rusty Brock.
Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Danny Hensel, Sarah Leeson, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.